what to do. When I tried to make him look at me and answer me as to what he was doing, he shook me off. He gave me such a blow with his arm that I hit the wall. Someone was knocking now. I knew what he meant to do. Once more I tried to reach out for him, but he spun so fast I didn't even see him hit me. When I did see him, I was sprawled in the chair and he was opening the door. "Yes, come in, please. There's been an accident," he said to the young slave boy, and then, shutting the door, he took him from behind so that the boy never knew what happened. And even as he knelt over the body drinking, he beckoned for the child, who slid from the couch and went down on her knees and took the wrist offered her, quickly pushing back the cuff of the shirt. She gnawed first, as if she meant to devour his flesh, and then Lestat showed her what to do. He sat back and let her have the rest, his eye on the boy's chest, so that when the time came he bent forward and said, "No more. He's dying. You must never drink after the heart stops, or you'll be sick again, sick to death. Do you understand?" But she'd had enough. And she sat next to him, their backs against the legs of the settee, their legs stretched out on the floor. The boy died in seconds. I felt weary and sickened, as if the night had lasted a thousand years. I sat there watching them, the child drawing close to Lestat now, snuggling near him as he slipped his arm around her, though his indifferent eyes remained fixed on the corpse. Then he looked up at me. "Where is Mama?" asked the child softly. She had a voice equal to her physical beauty, clear like a little silver bell. It was sensual. She was sensual. Her eyes were as wide and clear as Babette's. You understand that I was barely aware of what all this meant. I knew what it might mean, but I was aghast. Now Lestat stood up and scooped her from the floor and came towards me. "She's our daughter," he said. "You're going to live with us now." He beamed at her, but his eyes were cold as if it were all a horrible joke. Then he looked at me and his face had conviction. He pushed her towards me. I found her on my lap, my arms around her, feeling again how soft she was, how plump her skin was, like the skin of warm fruit, plums warmed by sunlight. Her huge, luminescent eyes were fixed on me with trusting curiosity. "This is Louis, and I am Lestat," he said to her, dropping down beside her. She looked about and said that it was a pretty room, very pretty, but she wanted her mama. He had his comb out and was running it through her hair, holding the locks so as not to pull with the comb. Her hair was untangling and becoming like satin. She was the most beautiful child I'd ever seen, and now she glowed with the cold fire of a vampire. Her eyes were a woman's eyes. I could see it already. She would become white and spare like us, but not lose her shape. I understood now what Lestat had said about death, what he meant. I touched her neck where the two red puncture wounds were bleeding just a little. I took Lestat's handkerchief from the floor and touched it to her neck. "Your mama's left you with us. She wants you to be happy," he was saying with that same immeasurable confidence. "She knows we can make you very happy."
"I want some more," she said, turning to the corpse on the floor.
"No, not tonight. Tomorrow night," said Lestat. And he went to take the lady out of his coffin. The child slid off my lap, and I followed her. She stood watching as Lestat put the two ladies and the slave boy into the bed. He brought the covers up to their chins.
"Are they sick?"
asked the child. "Yes, Claudia," he said. "They're sick and they're dead. You see, they die when we drink from them." He came towards her and swung her up into his arms again. We stood there with her between us. I was mesmerized by her transformed, by her every gesture. She was not a child any longer. She was a vampire child.
"Now Louis was going to leave us," said Lestat, his eyes moving from my face to hers. "He was going to go away. But now he's not. Because he wants to stay and take care of you and make you happy." He looked at me. "You're not going, are you, Louis?"
"You bastard," I whispered to him. "You fiend."
"Such language in front of your daughter," he said.
"I'm not your daughter," she said with a silvery voice. "I'm my mama's daughter."
"No, dear, not any more," he said to her. He glanced at the window, and then he shut the bedroom door behind us and turned the key in the lock. "You're our daughter, Louis's daughter, and my daughter, do you see? Now, whom should you sleep with, Louis or me?" And then, looking at me, he said, "Perhaps you should sleep with Louis. After all, when I'm tired, I'm not so kind."
The vampire stopped. The boy said nothing.
"A child vampire?" he whispered finally.
The vampire glanced up suddenly, as though startled, though his body made no movement. He glared at the tape recorder as if it were something monstrous. The boy saw that the tape was almost out. Quickly he opened his briefcase and drew out a new cassette, clumsily fitting it into place. He looked at the vampire as he pressed the record button. The vampire's face looked weary, drawn, his cheekbones more prominent and his brilliant green eyes enormous. They had begun at dark, which had come early on this San Francisco winter night, and now it was just before 10 p.m. The vampire straightened and smiled and said calmly, "We are ready to go on."
"He'd done this to the little girl just to keep you with him?" asked the boy.
"That is difficult to say. It was a statement. I'm convinced that Lestat was a person who preferred not to think or talk about his motives or beliefs, even to himself. One of those people who must act. Such a person must be pushed considerably before he will open up and confess that there is method and thought to the way he lives. That is what had happened that night with Lestat. He'd been pushed to where he had to discover, even for himself, why he lived as he did. Keeping me with him, that was undoubtedly part of what pushed him, but I think in retrospect that he himself wanted to know his own reasons for killing, wanted to examine his own life. He was discovering, when he spoke, what he did believe. But he did indeed want me to remain. He lived with me in a way he could never have lived alone. And as I've told you, I was careful never to sign any property over to him which maddened him. That he could not persuade me to do." The vampire laughed suddenly. "Look at all the other things he persuaded me to do. How strange! He could persuade me to kill a child, but not to part with my money." He shook his head. "But," he said, "it wasn't greed, really, as you can see. It was fear of him that made me tight with him."
"You speak of him as if he were dead. You say Lestat was this, or was that. Is he dead?" asked the boy.
"I don't know," said the vampire. "I think perhaps he is. But I'll come to that. We were talking of Claudia, weren't we? There was something else I wanted to say about Lestat's motives that night. Lestat trusted no one, as you see. He was like a cat, by his own admission, a lone predator. Yet he had communicated with me that night. He had, to some extent, exposed himself simply by telling the truth. He had dropped his mockery, his condescension. He had forgotten his perpetual anger for just a little while. And this for Lestat was exposure. When we stood alone in that dark street, I felt in him a communion with another I hadn't felt since I died. I rather think that he ushered Claudia into vampirism for revenge."
"Revenge, not only on you but on the world," suggested the boy.
"Yes. As I said,
Lestat's motives for everything revolved around revenge.
Was it all started with a father? With the school?
I don't know. I doubt it, said the vampire. But I want to go on.
Oh, please go on.
You have to go on. I mean, it's only 10 o'clock. The boy showed his watch. The vampire looked at it, and then he smiled at the boy. The boy's face changed. It was blank, as if from some sort of shock.
"Are you still afraid of me?"
asked the vampire. The boy said nothing, but he shrank slightly from the edge of the table. His body elongated, his feet moved out over the bare boards, and then contracted.
"I should think you'd be very foolish if you weren't," said the vampire. "But don't be."
"Shall we go on?"
"Please," said the boy.
He gestured towards the machine.
"Well," the vampire began, "our life was much changed with Mademoiselle Claudia, as you can imagine. Her body died, yet her senses awakened much as mine had, and I treasured in her the signs of this. But I was not aware for quite a few days how much I wanted her, wanted to talk with her and be with her. At first, I thought only of protecting her from Lestat. I gathered her into my coffin every morning and would not let her out of my sight with him, if possible. This was what Lestat wanted, and he gave little suggestions that he might do her harm. 'A starving child is a frightful sight,' he said to me. 'A starving vampire even worse.' 'They'd hear her screams in Paris,' he said, 'were he to lock her away to die.' But all this was meant for me, to draw me close and keep me there. Afraid of fleeing alone, I would not conceive of risking it with Claudia. She was a child. She needed care. And there was much pleasure in caring for her. She forgot her 5 years of mortal life at once, or so it seemed, for she was mysteriously quiet. And from time to time I even feared that she had lost all sense, that the illness of her mortal life, combined with the great vampire shock, might have robbed her of reason. But this proved hardly the case. She was simply unlike Lestat and me to such an extent I couldn't comprehend her. For little child she was, but also fierce killer, now capable of the ruthless pursuit of blood with all a child's demanding. And though Lestat still threatened me with danger to her, he did not threaten her at all, but was loving to her, proud of her beauty, anxious to teach her that we must kill to live, and that we ourselves could never die. The plague raged in the city then, as I've indicated, and he took her to the stinking cemeteries, where the yellow fever and plague victims lay in heaps, while the sounds of shovels never ceased all through the day and night. 'This is death,' he told her, pointing to the decaying corpse of a woman, 'which we cannot suffer. Our bodies will stay always as they are, fresh and alive. But we must never hesitate to bring death, because it is how we live.' And Claudia gazed on this with inscrutable liquid eyes. If there was not understanding in the early years, there was no smattering of fear. Mute and beautiful, she played with dolls, dressing, undressing them by the hour. Mute and beautiful, she killed. And I, transformed by Lestat's instruction, was now to seek out humans in much greater numbers. But it was not only the killing of them that soothed some pain in me, which had been constant in the dark, still nights on Pointe du Lac, when I sat with only the company of Lestat and the old man. It was their great, shifting numbers everywhere in streets which never grew quiet, cabarets which never shut their doors, balls which lasted till dawn, the music and laughter streaming out of the open windows. People all around me now, my pulsing victims, not seen with that great love I'd felt for my sister and Babette, but with some new detachment and need. And I did kill them, kills infinitely varied and great distances apart, as I walked with a vampire's sight and light movement through this teeming, burgeoning city, my victims surrounding me, seducing me, inviting me to their supper tables, their carriages, their brothels,
I lingered only a short while, long enough to take what I must have, soothed in my great melancholy that the town gave me an endless train of magnificent strangers. For that was it. I fed on strangers. I drew only close enough to see the pulsing beauty, the unique expression, the new and passionate voice, then killed before those feelings of revulsion could be aroused in me, that fear, that sorrow. Claudia and Lestat might hunt and seduce, stay long in the company of the doomed victim, enjoying the splendid humor in his unwitting friendship with death. But I still could not bear it. And so to me the swelling population was a mercy, a forest in which I was lost, unable to stop myself, whirling too fast for thought or pain, accepting again and again the invitation to death rather than extending it. We lived, meantime, in one of my new Spanish townhouses in the Rue Royale, a long, lavish upstairs flat above a shop I rented to a tailor, a hidden garden court behind us, a wall secure against the street with fitted wooden shutters and a barred carriage door, a place of far greater luxury and security than Pont du Lac. Our servants were free people of color, who left us to solitude before dawn for their own homes, and Lestat bought the very latest imports from France and Spain, crystal chandeliers and oriental carpets, silk screens with painted birds of paradise, canaries singing in great domed golden cages, and delicate marble Grecian gods and beautifully painted Chinese vases. I did not need the luxury any more than I had needed it before, but I found myself enthralled with a new flood of art and craft and design, could stare at the intricate pattern of the carpets for hours, or watch the gleam of the lamplight change the somber colors of a Dutch painting. All this Claudia found wondrous with the quiet awe of an unspoiled child, and marveled when Lestat hired a painter to make the walls of her room a magical forest of unicorns and golden birds and laden fruit trees over sparkling streams. An endless train of dressmakers and shoemakers and tailors came to our flat to outfit Claudia in the best of children's fashions, so that she was always a vision, not just of child beauty with her curling lashes and her glorious yellow hair, but of the taste of finely trimmed bonnets and tiny lace gloves, flaring velvet coats and capes, and sheer white puffed sleeve gowns with gleaming blue sashes. Lestat played with her as if she were a magnificent doll, and I played with her as if she were a magnificent doll. And it was her pleading that forced me to give up my rusty black for dandy jackets and silk ties and soft grey coats and gloves and black capes. Lestat thought the best colour at all times for vampires was black, possibly the only aesthetic principle he steadfastly maintained, but he wasn't opposed to anything which smacked of style and excess. He loved the great figure we got, the three of us in our box at the new French opera house, or the Théâtre d'Orléans, to which we went as often as possible, Lestat having a passion for Shakespeare which surprised me, though he often dozed through the operas and woke just in time to invite some lovely lady to midnight supper, where he would use all his skill to make her love him totally, then dispatch her violently to heaven or hell, and come home with her diamond ring to give to Claudia. And all this time I was educating Claudia, whispering in her tiny seashell ear that our eternal life was useless to us if we did not see the beauty around us, the creation of mortals everywhere. I was constantly sounding the depth of her still gaze as she took the books I gave her, whispered the poetry I taught her, and played with a light but confident touch her own strange, coherent songs on the piano. She could fall for hours into the pictures in a book and listen to me read until she sat so still the sight of her jarred me, made me put the book down and just stare back at her across the lighted room. Then she'd move, a doll coming to life, and say in the softest voice that I must read some more. And then strange things began to happen. For though she said little and was the chubby, round-fingered child still, I'd find her tucked in the arm of my chair reading the work of Aristotle, or Boethius, or a new novel just come over the Atlantic, or pecking out the music of Mozart we'd only heard the night before, with an infallible ear and a concentration that made her ghostly as she sat there, hour after hour, discovering the music, the melody, then the bass, and finally bringing it together. Claudia was mystery. It was not possible to know what she knew or did not know, and to watch her kill was chilling. She would sit alone in the dark square, waiting for the kindly gentleman or woman to find her, her eyes more mindless than I had ever seen Lestat's. Like a child, numbed with fright, she would whisper her plea for help to her gentle, admiring patrons, and as they carried her out of the square, her arms would fix about their necks, her tongue between her teeth, her vision glazed with consuming hunger. They found death fast in those first years, before she learned to play with them, to lead them to the doll shop or the café, where they gave her steaming cups of chocolate or tea to ruddy her pale cheeks, cups she pushed away, waiting, waiting, as if feasting silently on their terrible kindness. But when that was done, she was my companion, my pupil. Her long hours spent with me consuming faster and faster the knowledge I gave her, sharing with me some quiet understanding which could not include Lestat. At dawn she lay with me, her heart beating against my heart. And many times when I looked at her, when she was at her music or painting and didn't know I stood in the room, I thought of that singular experience I'd had with her and no other, that I had killed her, taken her life from her, had drunk all of her life's blood in that fatal embrace I'd lavished on so many others, others who lay now mouldering in the damp earth. But she lived. She lived to put her arms around my neck, and press her tiny cupid's bow to my lips, and put her gleaming eye to my eye until our lashes touched, and, laughing, we reeled about the room as if to the wildest waltz. Father and daughter. Lover and lover. You can imagine how well it was. Lestat did not envy us this, but only smiled on it from afar, waiting until she came to him. Then he would take her out into the street, and they would wave to me beneath the window, off to share what they shared, the hunt, the seduction, the kill. Years passed in this way. Years and years and years. Yet it wasn't until some time had passed that an obvious fact occurred to me about Claudia. I suppose from the expression on your face you've already guessed, and you wonder why I didn't guess. I can only tell you, time is not the same for me, nor was it for us then. Day did not link to day, making a taut and jerking chain. Rather, the moon rose over lapping waves. "Her body," the boy said. "She was never to grow up." The vampire nodded. "She was to be the demon child forever," he said, his voice soft as if he wondered at it. "Just as I am the young man I was when I died. And Lestat? The same. But her mind, it was a vampire's mind, and I strained to know how she moved towards womanhood. She came to talk more, though she was never other than a reflective person, and could listen to me patiently by the hour without interruption. Yet more and more her doll-like face seemed to possess two totally aware adult eyes, and innocence seemed lost somewhere with neglected toys and the loss of a certain patience. There was something dreadfully sensual about her lounging on the settee in a tiny nightgown of lace and stitched pearls. She became an eerie and powerful seductress, her voice as clear and sweet as ever, though it had a resonance which was womanish, a sharpness sometimes that proved shocking. After days of her usual quiet, she would scoff suddenly at Lestat's predictions about the war, or drinking blood from a crystal glass, say that there were no books in the house, we must get more, even if we had to steal them, and then coldly tell me of a library she'd heard of, in a palatial mansion in the Faubourg Saint-Marie, a woman who collected books as if they were rocks or pressed butterflies. She asked if I might get her into the woman's bedroom. I was aghast at such moments. Her mind was unpredictable, unknowable, but then she would sit on my lap and put her fingers in my hair and doze there against my heart, whispering to me softly. I should never be as grown up as she until I knew that killing was the more serious thing, not the books, the music. "Always the music," she whispered. "Doll, doll," I called her. That's what she was. A magic doll. Laughter and infinite intellect, and then the round-cheeked face, the bud mouth. "Let me dress you. Let me brush your hair," I would say to her out of old habit, aware of her smiling and watching me with a thin veil of boredom over her expression. "Do as you like," she breathed into my ear, as I bent down to fasten her pearl buttons. "Only kill with me tonight. You never let me see you kill, Louis." She wanted a coffin of her own now, which left me more wounded than I would let her see. I walked out after giving my gentlemanly consent. For how many years had I slept with her as if she were part of me, I couldn't know. But then I found her near the Ursuline convent, an orphan lost in the darkness, and she ran suddenly towards me and clutched at me with a human desperation. "I don't want it if it hurts you," she confided so softly that a human embracing us both could not have heard her or felt her breath. "I'll stay with you always, but I must see it, don't you understand? A coffin for a child." We were to go to the coffin makers. A play. A tragedy in one act. I to leave her in his little parlour and confide to him in the anteroom that she was to die. Talk of love. She must have the best, but she must not know. And the coffin maker, shaken with the tragedy of it, must make it for her, picturing her laid there on the white satin, dabbing a tear from his eye despite all the years. "But why, Claudia?" I pleaded with her. I loathed to do it, loathed cat and mouse with a helpless human. But hopelessly her lover, I took her there and set her on the sofa, where she sat with folded hands in her lap, her tiny bonnet bent down, as if she didn't know what we whispered about her in the foyer. The undertaker was an old and greatly refined man of colour, who drew me swiftly aside lest the baby should hear. "But why must she die?" he begged me, as if I were God who ordained it. "Her heart. She cannot live," I said, the words taking on for me a peculiar power, a disturbing resonance. The emotion in his narrow, heavily lined face disturbed me. Something came to my mind, a quality of light, a gesture, the sound of something, a child crying in a stench-filled room. Now he unlocked one after another of his long rooms and showed me the coffins, black lacquer and silver. She wanted that. And suddenly I found myself backing away from him, out of the coffin house, hurriedly taking her hand. "The order's been taken," I said to her. "It's driving me mad." I breathed the fresh air of the street as though I'd been suffocated, and then I saw her compassionless face studying mine. She slipped her small gloved hand back into my own.
"I want it, Louis," she explained patiently.
And then one night she climbed the undertaker's stairs, Lestat beside her, for the coffin, and left the coffin-maker unawares, dead across the dusty piles of papers on his desk. And there the coffin lay in our bedroom, where she watched it often by the hour when it was new, as if the thing were moving or alive, or unfolded some mystery to her little by little as things do which change. But she did not sleep in it. She slept with me. There were other changes in her. I cannot date them or put them in order. She did not kill indiscriminately. She fell into demanding patterns. Poverty began to fascinate her. She begged Lestat or me to take a carriage out through the Faubourg Saint-Marie to the riverfront places where the immigrants lived. She seemed obsessed with the women and children. These things Lestat told me with great amusement, for I was loath to go, and would sometimes not be persuaded under any circumstance. But Claudia had a family there, which she took, one by one, and she had asked to enter the cemetery of the suburb city of Lafayette, and there roam the high, marble tombs, in search of those desperate men who, having no place else to sleep, spend what little they have on a bottle of wine and crawl into a rotting vault. Lestat was impressed, overcome. What a picture he made of her, the infant death, he called her, sister death and sweet death, and for me, mockingly, he had the term with a sweeping bow, merciful death, which he said like a woman clapping her hands and shouting out a word of exciting gossip, "Oh, merciful heavens!" so that I wanted to strangle him. But there was no quarrelling. We kept to ourselves. We had our adjustments. Books filled our long flat from floor to ceiling in row after row of gleaming leather volumes, as Claudia and I pursued our natural tastes, and Lestat went about his lavish acquisitions, until she began to ask questions. The vampire stopped, and the boy looked as anxious as before, as if patience took the greatest effort. But the vampire had brought his long white fingers together as if to make a church steeple, and then folded them and pressed his palms tight. It was as if he'd forgotten the boy altogether.
"I should have known," he said, "that it was inevitable, and I should have seen the signs of it coming. For I was so attuned to her. I loved her so completely. She was so much the companion of my every waking hour, the only companion that I had other than death. I should have known." But something in me was conscious of an enormous gulf of darkness very close to us, as though we walked always near a sheer cliff, and might see it suddenly but too late if we made the wrong turn, or became too lost in our thoughts. Sometimes the physical world about me seemed insubstantial except for that darkness, as if a fault in the earth were about to open, and I could see the great crack breaking down the Rue Royale, and all the buildings were falling to dust in the rumble. But worst of all, they were transparent, gossamer, like stage drops made of silk. Ah, I'm distracted. What do I say? That I ignored the signs in her, that I clung desperately to the happiness she'd given me, and still gave me, and ignored all else. But these were the signs. She grew cold to Lestat. She fell to staring at him for hours. When he spoke, often she didn't answer him, and one could hardly tell if it was contempt or that she didn't hear. And our fragile domestic tranquillity erupted with his outrage. He did not have to be loved, but he would not be ignored. And once he even flew at her, shouting that he would slap her, and I found myself in the wretched position of fighting him as I'd done years before she'd come to us. "She's not a child any longer," I whispered to him. "I don't know what it is. She's a woman." I urged him to take it lightly, and he affected disdain and ignored her in turn. But one evening he came in flustered, and told me she'd followed him. Though she'd refused to go with him to kill, she'd followed him afterwards. "What's the matter with her?" he flared at me, as though I'd given birth to her and must know. And then one night, our servants vanished. Two of the best maids we'd ever retained, a mother and daughter. The coachman was sent to their house only to report they'd disappeared. And then the father was at our door, pounding the knocker. He stood back on the brick sidewalk, regarding me with that grave suspicion that sooner or later crept into the faces of all mortals who knew us for any length of time, the forerunner of death, as pallor might be to a fatal fever. But I tried to explain to him that they had not been here, mother or daughter, and we must begin some search. "It's she," Lestat hissed from the shadows when I shut the gate. "She's done something to them and brought risk for us all. I'll make her tell me,
and he pounded up the spiral stairs from the courtyard. I knew that she'd gone, slipped out while I was at the gate, and I knew something else also, that a vague stench came across the courtyard from the shut, unused kitchen, a stench that mingled uneasily with the honeysuckle, the stench of graveyards. I heard Lestat coming down as I approached the warped shutters, locked with rust to the small brick building. No food was ever prepared there, no work ever done, so that it lay like an old brick vault under the tangles of honeysuckle. The shutters came loose, the nails having turned to dust, and I heard Lestat's gasp as we stepped into the reeking dark. There lay on the bricks, mother and daughter together. The arm of the mother fastened around the waist of the daughter's head bent against the mother's breast, both foul with feces and swarming with insects. A great cloud of gnats rose as the shutter fell back, and I waved them away from me in a convulsive disgust. Ants crawled undisturbed over the eyelids, the mouths of the dead pair, and in the moonlight I could see the endless map of silvery paths of snails. "Damn her!" Lestat burst out, and I grabbed his arm and held him fast, pitting all my strength against him. "What do you mean to do with her?" I insisted. "What can you do? She's not a child anymore that will do what we say simply because we say it. We must teach her."
"She knows!" He stood back from me, brushing his coat. "She knows. She's known for years what to do, what can be risked and what cannot. I won't have her do this without my permission. I won't tolerate it."
"Then are you master of us all? You didn't teach her that. Was she supposed to imbibe it from my quiet subservience?" "I don't think so. She sees herself as equal to us now, and us as equal to each other. I tell you, we must reason with her, instruct her to respect what is ours, as all of us should respect it." He stalked off, obviously absorbed in what I'd said, though he would give no admission of it to me, and he took his vengeance to the city. Yet when he came home, fatigued and satiated, she was still not there. He sat against the velvet arm of the couch and stretched his long legs out on the length of it. "Did you bury them?" he asked me. "They're gone," I said. I did not care to say even to myself that I had burned their remains in the old unused kitchen stove. "But there is the father to deal with, and the brother," I said to him. I feared his temper. I wished at once to plan some way to quickly dispose of the whole problem, but he said now that the father and the brother were no more, that death had come to dinner in their small house near the ramparts, and stayed to say grace when everyone was done. "Wine," he whispered now, running his finger on his lip. "Both of them had drunk too much wine. I found myself tapping the fence posts with a stick to make a tune." He laughed. "But I don't like it, the dizziness. Do you like it?" And when he looked at me, I had to smile at him because the wine was working in him, and he was mellow. And in that moment when his face looked warm and reasonable, I leaned over and said, "I hear Claudia's tap on the stairs. Be gentle with her. It's all done." She came in then, with her bonnet ribbons undone and her little boots caked with dirt. I watched them tensely, Lestat with a sneer on his lips, she as unconscious of him as if he weren't there. She had a bouquet of white chrysanthemums in her arms, such a large bouquet it made her all the more a small child. Her bonnet fell back now, hung on her shoulder for an instant and then fell to the carpet. And all through her golden hair I saw the narrow petals of the chrysanthemums. "Tomorrow is the Feast of All Saints," she said. "Do you know?" "Yes," I said to her. "It is the day in New Orleans when all the faithful go to the cemeteries to care for the graves of their loved ones. They whitewash the plaster walls of the vaults, clean the names cut into the marble slabs, and finally they deck the tombs with flowers. In the St. Louis Cemetery, which was very near our house, in which all the great Louisiana families were buried, in which my own brother was buried, There were even little iron benches set before the graves where the families might sit to receive the other families who had come to the cemetery for the same purpose. It was a festival in New Orleans, a celebration of death, it might have seemed to tourists who didn't understand it, but it was a celebration of the life after.
"I bought this from one of the vendors," Claudia said. Her voice was soft and inscrutable, her eyes opaque and without emotion.
"For the two you left in the kitchen?" Lestat said fiercely. She turned to him for the first time, but she said nothing. She stood there staring at him as if she'd never seen him before. And then she took several steps towards him and looked at him, still as if she were positively examining him. I moved forward. I could feel his anger, her coldness. And now she turned to me. And then, looking from one to the other of us, she asked,
"Which of you did it? Which of you made me what I am?"
I could not have been more astonished at anything she might have said or done, and yet it was inevitable that her long silence would thus be broken. She seemed very little concerned with me, though, her eyes fixed on Lestat.
"You speak of us as if we always existed as we are now," she said,
her voice soft, measured, the child's tone rounded with a woman's seriousness.
"You speak of them out there as mortals, us as vampires. But it was not always so. Louis had a mortal sister, I remember her. And there is a picture of her in his trunk. I've seen him look at it. He was mortal the same as she, and so was I. Why else this size, this shape?"
She opened her arms now and let the chrysanthemums fall to the floor. I whispered her name. I think I meant to distract her. It was impossible. The tide had turned. Lestat's eyes burned with a keen fascination, a malignant pleasure.
"You made us what we are, didn't you?"
she accused him. He raised his eyebrows now in mock amazement. "What are you?" he asked. "And would you be something other than what you are?" He drew up his knees and leaned forward, his eyes narrow. "Do you know how long it's been? Can you picture yourself? Must I find a hag to show you your mortal countenance now if I had let you alone?" She turned away from him, stood for a moment as if she had no idea what she would do, and then she moved towards the chair beside the fireplace and, climbing on it, curled up like the most helpless child. She brought her knees up close to her, her velvet coat open, her silk dress tight around her knees, and she stared at the ashes in the hearth. But there was nothing helpless about her stare. Her eyes had independent life, as if the body were possessed. "You could be dead by now if you were mortal," Lestat insisted to her, pricked by her silence. He drew his legs around and set his boots on the floor. "Do you hear me? Why do you ask me this now? Why do you make such a thing of it? You've known all your life you're a vampire."
And so he went on in a tirade, saying much the same things he'd said to me many times over. "Know your nature, kill, be what you are."
But all of this seemed strangely beside the point, for Claudia had no qualms about killing. She sat back now and let her head roll slowly to where she could see him across from her. She was studying him again, as if he were a puppet on strings.
"Did you do it to me? And how?" she asked, her eyes narrowing. "How did you do it?"
"And why should I tell you? It's my power."
"Why yours alone?" she asked, her voice icy, her eyes heartless. "How was it done?" she demanded suddenly in rage.
"It was electric. He rose from the couch, and I was on my feet immediately facing him. "Stop her," he said to me. He wrung his hands. "Do something about her. I can't endure her." And then he started for the door, but turned and, coming back, drew very close so that he towered over Claudia, putting her in a deep shadow. She glared up at him, fearlessly, her eyes moving back and forth over his face with total detachment. "I can undo what I did, both to you and to him," he said to her, his finger pointing at me across the room. "Be glad I made you what you are," he sneered. or I'll break you in 1,000 pieces.
Well, the peace of the house was destroyed, though there was quiet. Days passed, and she asked no questions, though now she was deep into books of the occult, of witches and witchcraft, and of vampires.
This was mostly fancy, you understand, myth, tales, sometimes mere romantic horror tales, but she read it all. Till dawn she read, so that I had to go and collect her and bring her to bed. Well, Lestat, meantime, hired a butler and maid and had a team of workers in, to make a great fountain in the courtyard with a stone nymph pouring water eternal from a wide-mouthed shell.
He had goldfish brought, and boxes of rooted water lilies set into the fountain so their blossoms rested upon the surface and shivered in the ever-moving water. A woman had seen him kill on the Niad Road, which ran to the town of Carrollton, and there were stories of it in the paper, associating him with a haunted house near Niad and Melpomene, all of which delighted him. He was the Niad Road ghost for some time, though it finally fell to the back pages, and then he performed another grisly murder in another public place and set the imagination of New Orleans to working. But all this had about it some quality of fear. He was pensive, suspicious, and drew close to me constantly to ask where Claudia was, where she'd gone, and what she was doing. "She'll be all right," I assured him, though I was estranged from her and in agony as if she'd been my bride. She hardly saw me now, as she'd not seen Lestat before, and she might walk away while I spoke to her. "She had better be all right," he said, nastily. "And what will you do if she's not?" I asked, more in fear than accusation. He looked up at me with his cold grey eyes. "You take care of her, Louis. You talk to her," he said. "Everything was perfect, and now this. There's no need for it." But it was my choice to let her come to me, and she did. It was early one evening when I just awakened. The house was dark. I saw her standing by the French windows. She wore puffed sleeves and a pink sash, and was watching with lowered lashes the evening rush in the Rue Royale. I could hear Lestat in his room, the sound of water splashing from his pitcher. The faint smell of his cologne came and went, like the sound of music from the café 2 doors down from us.
"He'll tell me nothing," she said softly.
I hadn't realized she knew that I had opened my eyes. I came towards her and knelt beside her.
"You'll tell me, won't you, how it was done?"
"Is this what you truly want to know?" I asked, searching her face. "Or is it why it was done to you, and what you were before? I don't understand what you mean by how, for if you mean how was it done so that you in turn may do it?"
"I don't even know what it is, what you're saying," she said with a touch of coldness.
Then she turned full around and put her hands on my face.
"Kill with me tonight," she whispered as sensuously as a lover, "and tell me all that you know. What are we? Why are we not like them?"
She looked down into the street. "I don't know the answers to your questions," I said to her. Her face contorted suddenly, as if she was straining to hear me over a sudden noise, and then she shook her head. But I went on. "I wonder the same things you wonder. I do not know. How I was made, I'll tell you that Lestat did it to me. But the real how of it, I don't know." Her face had that same look of strain. I was seeing it in the first traces of fear, or something worse and deeper than fear. "Claudia," I said to her, putting my hands over her hands and pressing them gently against my skin, "Lestat has one wise thing to tell you. Don't ask these questions. You've been my companion for countless years in my search for all that I could learn of mortal life and mortal creation. Don't be my companion now in this anxiety. He can't give us the answers, and I have none." I could see she could not accept this, But I hadn't expected the convulsive turning away, the violence with which she tore at her own hair for an instant and then stopped as if the gesture were useless, stupid. It filled me with apprehension. She was looking at the sky. It was smoky, starless, the clouds blowing fast from the direction of the river. She made a sudden movement of her lips, as if she'd bitten into them. Then she turned to me, and, still whispering, she said,
"Then he made me. He did it. You did not."
There was something so dreadful about her expression. I'd left her before I meant to do it. I was standing before the fireplace, lighting a single candle in front of the tall mirror, and there, suddenly, I saw something which startled me, gathering out of the gloom first as a hideous mask, then becoming its three-dimensional reality, a weathered skull. I stared at it. It smelled faintly of the earth still, but had been scrubbed.
"Why don't you answer me?"
she was asking. I heard Lestat's door open. He would go out to kill at once, at least to find the kill. I would not. I would let the first hours of the evening accumulate in quiet as hunger accumulated in me, till the drive grew almost too strong, so that I might give myself to it all the more completely, blindly. I heard her question again clearly, as though it had been floating in the air like the reverberation of a bell, and felt my heart pounding.
"He did make me, of course. He said so himself. But you hide something from me. Something he hints at when I question him. He says that it could not have been done without you."
I found myself staring at the skull, yet hearing her as if the words were lashing me to make me turn around and face the lash. The thought went through me more like a flash of cold than a thought, that nothing should remain of me now but such a skull. I turned around and saw, in the light from the street, her eyes, like two dark flames in her white face. A doll from whom someone had cruelly ripped the eyes and replaced them with a demonic fire. I found myself moving towards her, whispering her name, some thought forming on my lips, then dying, coming towards her, then away from her, fussing for her coat and her hat. I saw a tiny glove on the floor, which was phosphorescent in the shadows, and for just a moment I thought it a tiny, severed hand.
"What's the matter with you?"
She drew nearer, looking up into my face.
"What has always been the matter? Why do you stare at the skull like that, at the glove?"
She asked this gently, but not gently enough. There was a slight calculation in her voice, an unreachable detachment.
"I need you," I said to her, without wanting to say it. "I cannot bear to lose you. You're the only companion I have in immortality." "But surely there must be others. Surely we are not the only vampires on earth."
I heard her saying it as I had said it, heard my own words coming back to me now on the tide of her self-awareness, her searching. "But there's no pain," I thought suddenly. "There's urgency, heartless urgency." I looked down at her.
"Aren't you the same as I?"
She looked at me.
"You've taught me all I know."
"Lestat taught you to kill." I fetched the glove. "Here, come, let's go out." "I want to go out." I was stammering, trying to force the gloves on her. I lifted the great curly mass of her hair and placed it gently over her coat.
"But you taught me to see," she said. "You taught me the words vampire eyes," she said. "You taught me to drink the world, to hunger for more than—"
"I never meant those words that way, vampire eyes," I said to her. "It has a different ring when you say it." She was tugging at me, trying to make me look at her. "Come," I said to her. "I've something to show you." And quickly I led her down the passage and down the spiral stairs through the dark courtyard. But I no more knew what I had to show her really than I knew where I was going, only that I had to move toward it with a sublime and doomed instinct. We rushed through the early evening city, the sky overhead a pale violet now that the clouds were gone, the stars small and faint, The air around us sultry and fragrant even as we moved away from the spacious gardens, towards those mean and narrow streets where the flowers erupt in the cracks of the stones, and the huge oleander shoots out thick, waxen stems of white and pink blooms, like a monstrous weed in the empty lots. I heard the staccato of Claudia's steps as she rushed beside me, never once asking me to slacken my pace, and she stood finally, her face infinitely patient, looking up at me in a dark and narrow street, where a few old slope-roofed French houses remained among the Spanish facades, ancient little houses, the plaster blistered from the mouldering brick beneath. I had found the house now by a blind effort, aware that I had always known where it was and avoided it, always turned before this dark, lampless corner, not wishing to pass the low window where I'd first heard Claudia cry. The house was standing still, sunk lower than it was in those days, the alleyway crisscrossed with sagging cords of laundry, the weeds high along the low foundation, the two dormer windows broken and patched with cloth. I touched the shutters. "It was here I first saw you," I said to her, thinking to tell it to her so she would understand, yet feeling now the chill of her gaze, the distance of her stare. "I heard you crying. You were there in a room with your mother, and your mother was dead. Dead for days, and you didn't know. You clung to her, whining, crying pitifully, your body white and feverish and hungry. You were trying to wake her from the dead. You were hugging her for warmth, for fear. It was almost morning, and..." I put my hand to my temples. I opened the shutters. I came into the room. I felt pity for you. Pity. But something else. I saw her lips slack, her eyes wide. "You fed on me?" she whispered. "I was your victim?" "Yes," I said to her. "I did it." There was a moment so elastic and painful as to be unbearable. She stood stark still in the shadows, her huge eyes gathering the light, the warm air rising suddenly with a soft noise, and then she turned. I heard the clicking of her slippers as she ran, and ran, and ran. I stood frozen, hearing the sound grow smaller and smaller, and then I turned, the fear in me unraveling, growing huge and insurmountable, and I ran after her. It was unthinkable that I not catch her, that I not overtake her at once and tell her that I loved her, must have her, must keep her, and every second that I ran headlong down the dark street after her was like her slipping away from me drop by drop. My heart was pounding, unfed, pounding and rebelling against the strain, until I came suddenly to a dead stop. She stood beneath a lamppost, staring mutely as if she didn't know me. I took her small waist in both hands and lifted her into the light. She studied me, her face contorted, her head turning as if she wouldn't give me her direct glance, as if she must deflect an overpowering feeling of revulsion.
"You killed me," she whispered. "You took my life."
"Yes," I said to her, holding her so that I could feel her heart pounding. "Rather, I tried to take it, to drink it away. But you had a heart like no other heart I've ever felt, a heart that beat and beat until I had to let you go, had to cast you away from me lest you quickened my pulse till I would die. And it was Lestat who found me out. Louis the sentimentalist, the fool, feasting on a golden-haired child, a holy innocent, a little girl. He brought you back from the hospital where they'd put you. And I never knew what he meant to do except teach me my nature. Take her, finish it, he said. And I felt that passion for you again. Oh, I know I've lost you now forever. I can see it in your eyes. You look at me as you look at mortals from aloft, from some region of cold self-sufficiency I can't understand. But I did it. I felt it for you again. A vile, unsupportable hunger for your hammering heart. This cheek, this skin. You were
pink and fragrant as mortal children are, sweet with the bite of salt and dust. I held you again. I took you again. And when I thought your heart would kill me and I didn't care, he parted us, and gashing his own wrist, gave it to you to drink. And drink you did. And drink until you nearly drained him and he was reeling, but you were a vampire then.